Wide Area and Resistance Radio calling. Wide Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is Wide Area and Resistance Radio, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker in North Central Indiana on a very frigid, very frosty day. Everything's covered with a coat of frost, and it's down in the 20s, so it's cool out there, but it's going to be a clear day, and maybe get a little sun if you're interested. All your correspondence to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And then go up to our big, giant website, resist.com, to get a Harvard education on the race issue. Yeah. And also, don't forget our national phone lines that we have, and we're running a whole show on those on those lines as an experiment. The number is 559-670-1473. That's the main national number. And we have another number. It's 641-715-3800. Now, this one's a little more difficult to bring up the message. You press 568 90*. Yeah, and then you can bring up the message. I just put a couple of new ones up there, ones you might have heard before, but not sure. So anyhow, check in once in a while. I change those messages about once every week, maybe once every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, free speech is pretty much a joke if you have anything important to say. And if you have something important to say, you have difficulty free speeching. Like I have to struggle with the local newspaper just to get a halfway decent letter into the column. And I'll tell you, you try to get something racial in there, forget it. They'd rather eat ground glass. But they keep talking about free speech, and everybody's got to have free speech, and we want everybody's opinion. But that's a lie. It's a lie on the national level, a lie on the local level. You have to really fight for it to get free speech. Free speech is not free. You got to sacrifice for it and struggle for it. And I just had a letter that they did print in the local paper here. It says, headline, War Criminals. I'm truly shocked that the CIA was ordered by Clinton, but even more by Bush and Obama, to use torture. The U.S. has used torture in every war we have stumbled into, and all military operations in history have used torture. All the other countries use torture also. But CIA torture is small potatoes when compared to the involvement in the mass torture of the entire Middle East population by illegal invasions. I'd call the invasion of Iraq, unconstitutional invasion of Iraq, certainly torture to hundreds of thousands of people that died. Trying to justify the actions of the entire military-industrial gang as defending the United States is moronic. Bush and Cheney are war criminals, pure and simple. Remember, war is a racket, and you pay all the bills. When's the last time you saw a racial spokesman on national television or even on regional television? I can't remember. There might have been one little local teeny bopper Klan group down in Ferguson, Missouri that got a little exposure, but you don't see, you know, and even in the 80s, a lot of the spokesmen, including myself, were all over TV. But now it's totally blocked off. And of course, we live in this democracy, this free speech democracy. Then they say, well, we can't say that because we offend the niggers, or we can't say that or we'll offend the mestizos, or we can't say that, or it'll offend the homosexuals, or we can't say that because it'll offend the transgendered people, or we can't say that because that, you know, and it goes on and on and on. So there is no such thing as free speech in this country. It's only the speech that's approved by the ruling class. And then, of course, you've got your main right-left situation with the lying Fox TV on one hand, and you got the MSNBC on the other hand. And once in a while, they get it right, but most of the time, it's wrong from the very start. When Al Jazeera first came on, I thought that was going to prove to be a fairly decent source of information, even though it's slanted. But it's become just as bad as the others. And now Russia TV, that I had great hopes for, is sort of moving in that direction also. So anything that starts out to be pretty out in the open and getting the free speech out, they either water it down or change it completely. So how are the young people or anybody else going to find about an intelligent progressive racism when you never get heard at all? In fact, if they have a symposium on race and racism, all the opponents of racism do all the talking, all the experts, all the college professors, all the politicians. They never invite a true racist spokesman to counterbalance anymore. I mean, they did that. They used to do that. In fact, the Fairness Doctrine back in the 70s that Reagan dumped, of course, where they had to give you equal time, because in San Diego, the media out there, when I lived in that area, any time the station came up with an editorial and went against my grain and a lot of other people's grain, I'd run right down and say, I want to get on here. And they'd let me on for a couple of minutes, maybe 3 minutes, to give my side of the view and many others' side of their view. And that's what we should have today. The Fairness Doctrine, of course, the ruling class, the Republican types, hated it because they got plenty of money to buy time, and most people don't. And so they said, oh, that's a commie, pinko, socialist, Democrat deal. And, well, of course, those people want to have a free speech, too. Everybody wants to get their ideas out there. So the Fairness Doctrine was a pretty damn good law until the war criminal Ronald Reagan, who had murdered hundreds and thousands of Central Americans on the pretext that they were communists, and also scaring the pants off of these Nicaraguans. There's thousands of them fled Nicaragua and came up to L.A. and Frisco and all over the place. So anyhow, that's the story on free speech. There ain't any really total free speech. I don't mean half free speech. I mean total free speech. If you find any, let me know. Of course, on the Internet, at least you can get your side out. But on the Internet, where they have these different Huffington Posts and so forth, I'm banned. I can't even comment on those. All those progressive left, almost all of them, I can't make a comment. And so they're even working on stifling free speech on the Internet if they can get away with it. So anybody in whatever power structure you're talking about, progressives, conservative, neocons, or whatever, they really don't want free speech. They want their speech. That's what they want. I just want you to listen to my speech. Your speech, fuck you.
With protesters today in hopes of bringing the two sides together, KTVU's Noelle Walker was there. It takes time and care to build anything. It starts with a strong foundation.
There was a relationship building between the community and the law enforcement.
So when protesters in the community of Richmond picked up the megaphone,
Richmond wants justice and peace.
Law enforcement
Richmond
joined them.
I
think is pretty awesome.
We have a lot of respect for our community. We share a lot of similar concerns.
And that's why I'm glad to see the chief, because here in Richmond, he's been very instrumental in taking away that divider.
Other protests in other cities, generally speaking, have police officers standing in a line right here, facing the protesters over there. Today, they're standing in one line together. That's Richmond's police chief, Chris Magnus.
We do want to send a message that all lives matter here in our city. Black.
Well, there we go. It gets weirder as it goes along. They got a blonde-haired police chief in Richmond, California. He's out there marching with the Negroes and Save a Black Life poster on his chest. You know how long this love affair is going to last? I don't think it'll last very long, and I don't think this chief of police is going to have a very good standing among his brother cops, I'll tell you that. So, but anyhow, it's funny how things go like this. They always have to have a new angle, man. It's amazing how white people keep hoping and praying that black people will begin to act as white people, that there'll be just colored brown like they had a paint job, but there'll be a white person underneath and act like a majority of white people doing the culture. I love it. Well, let's see what Louis Gohmert says about Central American gang violence. How about that? He's a senator, I believe, but I don't know what state he's from.
But during those nights I've spent down on the border, I was talking to a Hispanic border patrolman, and this follow-up of what you're saying. And you've heard, you know, there are so many tens of thousands of children that come across unaccompanied. Not a single young child ever comes across unaccompanied. I've watched them separate after they get over to our side, but they don't cross that river unaccompanied. But this border patrolman said, you know, we've got all these form questions we ask, and he said, you know, I will ask, we're supposed to ask, why did you leave your home country, Guatemala, El Salvador, and come here? And he said over 90% of the time, they say, to get away from gang violence. And he said, since I speak better Spanish than a lot of them, I don't let them get away with it. And I bear down on them and I say, now, you may find some gringo that buys that stuff, but you and I know you paid a gang to bring you into this country. So don't tell me you came to escape gang violence. And he said, then of those 90% that say that, 90% of them say, well, you're right, but we were told to say we're coming to escape gang violence. They know the game, and we need to get engaged.
Well, sorry for that interruption. I keep forgetting to unplug my phone. And I get interrupted once in a while. But that was a pretty good statement, you know, because, you see, that is what the government says qualifies you to come to this country, is that you're being persecuted and harassed and by the military or gang violence or whatever in another country. That's the main thing that the State Department asks, is that what happened to you? And then they open up the door. So obviously these wetbacks are told this to say that whenever they're asked. And it's more likely you're going to get to stay because you fear for your life and you can't go back. Then the first thing they do up on the West Coast is travel to L.A. to the barrio and East L.A. where even cops are afraid to go in there. Something that's interesting, this black Ben Carson that's been talking right-wing stuff all over the television. Since Ben Carson's ego is very clearly driving him to launch a bid for the White House, he obviously needs to travel to Israel first in a futile effort to prove that his campaign should be taken seriously. So there you go. You can't run for office without going to Israel, because you're not serious unless you go to Israel and pay homage. Well, I think this news story came out yesterday about the Hallmark removing the holiday gift wrap that looks like swastikas. Well, it may surprise a lot of people, but in Israel history, there are swastikas. I've seen pictures of Israel artifacts with swastikas on. So, anyhow, some gal, Cheryl Shapiro, called in and complained about Walgreens has this. Well, up until the 60s, I think, there were swastikas all over this country, and in several places, they're still there. I've seen them in entryways to hotels with in the marble or whatever, and in the mosaic swastikas. I've seen them on L.A., they got hundreds of lampposts, and as of when I remember, they had a swastika on them. I know Irv Rubin of the JDL made a big deal out of getting rid of those lampposts, and the city fathers told him to go to hell. Cost too much money, man. You Jews crying all the time. Anyhow, you're going to play hell getting rid of all those swastikas in one form or another. I mean, it's not just in the form of the German usage. It's been displayed in many other ways. But I'm moving back into a position I had a few years ago, and that is the Jolly Roger fits our mission much more than the swastika, because the Jolly Roger was flown by the privateers that had no allegiance to any country but their own situation. And that's the way we've got to move towards that, because if you're going to have too much allegiance towards any political state, you're going to be sorry, because it'll come back to hit you in the ass sooner or later. I think I'm going to go out here to the Walgreens store in Warsaw, Indiana, and say, I want the swastika wrapping paper, gift wrap. I want it, and I want it now, or I'm going to sue you. You hear that they're trying to knock out any move to have medical marijuana in Washington, D.C.? Actually, it's only one congressman that's pushing it, but this goes around the home rule situation, because a few years ago they changed the rules for Washington, D.C. to give them more privileges as a state. And obviously, it said except for really rough, bad situations, they should be able to rule themselves. Of course, they're mostly black, so that's going to be a problem. But the government shouldn't be interfering with the desires for people to have medical marijuana in Washington, D.C., because that's not doesn't rise to the magnitude of being a problem for the federal government. But it's a problem for some congressman who wants just to get his name in the paper. All day yesterday, I heard him calling in on the radio when I was driving down the road about the Stars and Bars, and how these guys want to fight to the death to keep that Confederate flag. Well, I'll tell you what, they say that represented anti-black or anti-slavery. Well, it can be whatever you want it to be, but you got to remember that essentially, as the flag of the Confederate states, it represented the ruling class and the plantation owners and the cotton industry. That was where all the power was, so that flag did that more than representing the common people, the working class whites, because most of them didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of in the South. It seems funny that the working class whites now, after all this time, would rise up and raise hell because we've got to have our Confederate flag. We got to have our Confederate flag. And considering that along with the Northern flag were the flags that caused hundreds of thousands of white men to die for the corporations and the fat cats and the cotton industry and the banking industry and so forth. So anyhow, I don't have much sympathy for these guys. However, I think that it would be great if they'd outlaw it, because that'll get you something going. I think if they outlaw the Confederate flag in the South, there will be a civil war. And that's fine with me. I'm all for it. So I'm not against flying the Confederate flag as long as it's what they're accused of by the blacks. And that's true. It's racist. It is a racist symbol. And even though the original intent was to champion the rights of the rich over the northern rights of the rich. Well, let's hear a little bit more about this torture thing that everybody denies, and Bush loved it. He's a psychopath, and for them to say even that it was being done but Bush didn't know about it, bullshit. He orchestrated that stuff. Him and Cheney, who's another sociopath, psychopath, all the past. They're all the past. They were all into it. They're sick boys. They're perverts.
When Glenn Carl joined the CIA, torture was not on his agenda.
You were fighting in the desert. You can say yes, and all this will stop. All this will stop. Yes, you were.
The agency did not have any trained interrogators or any interrogation program. It was created. The whole body of the executive branch of the United States government had authorized this.
It was discovered in Kandahar. That's what you were.
And I thought, holy smoke, this is unbelievable.
Don't look at me!
Although against international law, torture is still practiced in many countries. Under the Bush administration, the U.S. became one of them, using the euphemism enhanced interrogation techniques. Glenn received instructions on the manner and methods of approved torture, but he refused to participate.
Yes, you were fighting in Canada. Yes, you were!
It came to be codified, and the physical measures were where you can hit someone on the side of the head, you can throw him against the wall, you can punch him in the stomach.
Stay like that.
You can put him in a stress position.
6 inches!
Which can mean stand against the wall, lean your forehead against it, and move your feet back 6 inches. And you do that for 20 seconds, and you're fine. But if you do it for hours, it's excruciating. We know, without thinking about this, that the sun comes up every day, and then it goes down, and that you will have to eat regularly, and that you'll have to sleep regularly. Not when you're in the hands of us, because we will mess with everything, and you'll have blinding light and utter darkness. And then you'll be given a small meal, and it'll be taken away after 90 seconds, and you'll be brought another one an hour later.
You haven't eaten all day, ain't you hungry?
I just ate.
And you say, no, I'm the one with the clock. You don't have a clock. You don't know what you're talking about. And you haven't eaten for a day.
Chop, chop.
The main argument used to justify torture is the ticking bomb scenario, the idea that physical or mental pain may force a person to reveal vital information. However, there's little science to back that belief.
How do you even know there is a bomb in the first place? How do you know you've got the right person? And then how do you know he's going to tell you the truth, you know, in the time span that you have?
On your knees.
The terrorists are prepared. They don't come in ill-prepared, and so they're taught to withstand torture or to give false information.
That's better.
The theory is that by dislocating somebody psychologically, he will become more manipulable and more willing to share information. Both of those things are wrong.
I think, the whole purpose is to disorientate the person, is to loosen all their defense mechanisms, try to make sure that they feel completely cut off from the rest of the world. So they sort of just cast adrift, in a sense.
Hey!
Now, some people respond with what we call dissociation, where they go into a very narrow, focused state of consciousness. Or they may be in such an altered state of consciousness, you know, because of their deprivations and suffering, that they'll say all sorts of things.
Fire! I'm gonna say fire! Say it! You're a fighter, come on, say it! Yeah!
High high and persistent levels of stress can be damaging to the hippocampus, an area of the brain relating to memory.
What day was that?
And studies on soldiers show that manipulating sleep, food and temperature makes them less able to recall events accurately.
What's your uncle's name?
It's an alpha male kind of power trip. It does not work.
Are you a fighter?
Torture may not be a reliable way to extract information, but what it does do, very effectively, is leave behind a legacy of ruined individuals.
Well, I've been working with refugees in mental health for many years now, several decades. From what we do know, torture, perhaps in parallel with a few other forms of trauma, turns out to be the most severe trauma of all. And that's because these are repetitive, uncontrollable assaults on your dignity and your humanity and your life as well. We tend to focus on the disorder called post-traumatic stress disorder, but there are much wider range of issues as well.
Nhin Nguyen had the misfortune of being a fighter on the losing side in the Vietnam War. Following the fall of Saigon in 1975, he was placed in one of the infamous re-education camps.
When they announced the education re-education program, they said 10 days.
Nhin wasn't released for 6 years. During that time, he was subject to psychological torture, hard labor, and starvation.
I only live by my survival instinct. Frogs, snakes, rats, anything that's moving to eat. That in some way destroys your self-esteem, destroys your dignity, destroys your integrity, because you then become like a thief.
Incredibly, he spent 9 months in solitary in the dark.
They try to destroy you psychologically by killing your hope.
Nhin was finally released, but the trauma stayed with him.
I would have nightmare, and in the morning I would sweat all over. The next day, you know, I wouldn't want to do anything. The whole day, you know, I act like a zombie. I walk around, but my mind is still got stuck with the past, you know.
His condition became so severe, he was hospitalized twice for depression.
You want me to help me? Can you just hold this cup?
But Nin's life has been turned around by a remarkable treatment being used here at the Rehabilitation Center for Torture and Trauma Survivors, STARTS. It's called neurofeedback.
I mean, basically, neurofeedback is a process that allows you to train certain parts of the brain. One of the supposed analogies that we can use is that of physiotherapy. If you've got a muscle that, you know, that's not working properly and you want to play sport, you're not going to, you know, benefit much from coaching unless, you know, you fix that muscle.
Trauma has altered the way Nin's brain functions. The changes can be seen in abnormal brainwave patterns recorded by EEG.
So brainwave activity or patterns of firing of neurons really depends on our mental state. When we are fully alert, our brain is working faster. As we are getting tired or we are falling asleep, there is slower and slower rhythms that are appearing in our brain.
Brainwaves operate at different frequencies and represent different mental states. For example, alpha waves usually occur with our eyes closed when we're calm and relaxed. Beta waves reflect an alert, attentive state. High beta waves may indicate tension or anxiety. Gamma waves are for processing sensory information. Nin's brain waves seem to function in reverse.
Relax your shoulders. With eyes closed, instead of going into relaxed alpha state of mind, he had faster brain waves at the back of his head, and that was a sign that he was hypervigilant. What was happening with eyes open, instead of his brain going into faster rhythm and displaying more beta brain waves, his brain would go into quite slow rhythm and we had more alpha brain waves. That really showed that he was often dissociating and that he had huge difficulties with attention and concentration. Nin, I want you now to focus on the screen. Look at that blue rocket and just make it fly faster. Just with your mind.
Neurofeedback allows clients to consciously retrain their brain by using their brain waves as a controller. In this game, Nin has to lower his alpha and theta waves and raise his beta wave activity to make the rocket go faster. In other words, winning the game depends on training his brain waves towards a healthier pattern. If he loses concentration or if he becomes anxious, the rocket slows down. After just a few months' treatment with neurofeedback, brainwave patterns can be startlingly different.
So this is an EEG recording of a client before and after treatment.
So when you go from this completely erratic brainwave to this pattern, does that mean that his symptoms have improved?
Actually, that means that the client complaints are no longer existing. So we can say that when we look at this, this is a normal EEG. Usually clients that are referred to our clinic are clients with more severe problems and more severe clinical presentation. In our case, we can say we have around 85% success. And when I say success, that means that clients really recover from their trauma. So how was your week, Nin?
Neurofeedback is always combined with other therapies to maximize the healing potential.
And so we need to remember that, you know, it's just one tool, in the same way you wouldn't expect a tradesman to, you know, come to your house with just a hammer.
But for Nin, neurofeedback has worked wonders.
Nin had really remarkable recovery. Within 10 sessions, his brainwave patterns have changed completely. He was able to function better. So he was able to pay attention. His affect control has improved. He stopped having anger outbursts.
It gave me back the control that I have on myself, on my own life. I feel that I become more powerful instead of powerless. You know, I see things very rosy instead of very dark like before.
It's very important that you understand some of this that's going on, because at present, what you perceive is most of this is going on someplace else, overseas. But I can assure you that torture goes on in one form or another in every prison in this country and most jails. It's just that it doesn't get exposed, or not exposed enough. Now, I've been talking to POWs for a long time, and they relate to me the kinds of torture that are used inside the American prisons. And a lot of it is not just psychological, it's physical. And it's interesting to me that it seems that the farther south you go in this country, the more brutal and the more torturous the prisons are. Now, somebody may disagree with that, but that's what I see and what is reported to me by the treatment of federal and state prisoners and county jails, to where routinely guys get murdered and killed. And so anyhow, you better get used to resisting as much as possible this kind of activity, because it's coming our way. As the empire, slacks off and starts deteriorating, it's going to become far more dangerous than it is now. A lot of people think, well, it'll be more dangerous as it becomes stronger. No, any empire becomes worse as it deteriorates. Example, in India, when the British were, the empire was unraveling in India, they were building the biggest monuments and biggest buildings for the military and so forth, when they were actually getting pushed out of India. Or at least they chose to go out of India because it was costing too much money to administer. And the Brits and the Bank of England figured out that they didn't have to have an army there. They only had to buy one person, and that was the person handling the money and the treasury people in a country, the exchequer. Once you got those people under your control, you don't need an army there. But that's another story in itself. Actually, a certain low-grade torture is being used on the American people all the time. For an example, the crisis situation. There's always a crisis. And you're always worrying about it. And then, if you're not worried about it, you're un-American. But these crises come up, and they're there for about a week, and then there's another big crisis. And this is a form of torture, and it's it makes people into, well, it changes you quite a bit, a lot of people. Some people have they've been inoculated against it, but most people, it bothers them, keeps them in fear all the time. I mean, how else could you keep thousands and thousands of American troops in the Middle East by telling them they're protecting America? Unless you've got people so scared that they can see Al-Qaeda on the rowboats coming over here to the United States every day. Yeah, and so no matter if you're in a prison or in a foreign country, certain forms of torture are being used on you every day. And if you go against the grain, you'll find that out real quick. I mean, as long as you are a yes man to the system, it's a lower grade torture. But if you go against the grain and have a difference of opinion and want things done differently, then the torture goes up. And they can use many methods to torture you. Anybody that's been in a court of law over various things knows that. Now, there may be a crack between Cheney and Bush coming on here in the last 48 hours. Speaking to Fox News, Cheney denied Bush was kept out of the loop on torture. He said the then president was in fact an integral part of the program and he had to prove it. Well, if you didn't know that, you're behind times. I mean, you have to know the buck stops here with the president. Ask if Bush knew specific details of how specific interrogations were being conducted. Cheney was more vague, saying, "We did discuss the techniques. There was no effort on our part to keep him from that." So obviously Bush knew all about it in his perverted, psychopathic way. I liked it. And I'd like to see him tossed in Guantanamo and worked over. As almost all leaders, at least in this country, to rise to the top, put on a big false front of being strong men and women. But in fact, most of them are weak cowards. And they try to back up their cowardice with bravado and so forth, and waving the gun and all that kind of stuff. You know, all this stuff about Benghazi and going on and on about it, and Obama declaring innocence and not knowing all about it and all that kind of stuff. Well, it was obvious that Benghazi was a political headquarters there. It was not the top U.S. building or whatever, and consulate. It was a little side issue, and it was obviously a CIA with black room there, and they were torturing and these Al-Qaeda or whoever it was, they were using it as a place of torture. And I'm telling you what happened was that their Al-Qaeda buddies had stormed the place to break them out and to destroy the CIA torture room and the apparatus and so forth. That's what that was all about. And that, what was he, a politician? Or no, he was the ambassador or whatever. He was with those CIA people on this torture shit. And that's why he was done in, too. That's my opinion. I think it's the best idea or best opinion that's come along.
In a hurry, when a bunch of cocksure right-wing joyriders began screeching recklessly around a dicey political curve, only to find an 18-wheeler of contrary facts headed right at them. These joyriders are Republican leaders who've been wildly accusing President Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton of being responsible for what they call the Benghazi scandal. But the scandalmongers have now run head-on into the GOP's own House Intelligence Committee, which has delivered a truckload of truth that refutes each of their accusations. But rather than accept facts, the wild bunch turned on their own colleagues. Senator Lindsey Graham, one of the chief spouters of the conspiracy theory, offered this thoughtful analysis of the Intelligence Committee's findings. "I think the report's full of crap," he barked. You can imagine his frustration, for this is the fifth congressional committee to investigate 2012's deadly terrorist attack in Benghazi, Libya, and all five concluded that the fall of this diplomatic outpost was another lamentable result of terrorism, not a treacherous plot by top U.S. officials. But five crashes have only caused the ideologues to accelerate, and they've recently picked up House Speaker John Boehner to join their wild ride. Declaring with a straight face that the, quote, "American people still have far too many questions about that night in Benghazi to stop the partisan witch hunt," Boehner has created a special committee of the House to chase the Schumerical scandal. This is Jim Hightower saying, "No, no, Boehner. The American people have real worries, and Benghazi is not even on their list." But they are beginning to question the GOP's obsessive insanity over such a non-issue. The real scandal here is that Boehner is dumping another 3.3 million of our tax dollars into this endless farce.
Well, and guess what? The House Appropriations Bill has passed. $490 billion for the War Department. You call it the Defense Department. They call it the Defense. That was the coolest thing they ever did, was change from the War Department to the Defense Department. So no matter what we do, it's defense. It's always defense. And then there's a whole lot more that gets funneled into the military situation. $490 billion, and then people around here are complaining about the roads and so forth, but they don't seem to complain much about the military appropriations. Of course, the military-industrial complex and the predatory capitalists that are involved in that love it. They're making a fortune building things that will never be used, building things that don't work, like that new F-36, was it? Plane? It can't even be used. So anyhow, that's... So forget the Republican-Democrat split. That's just a fight among brothers and sisters. The whole thing is so corrupt it needs to come down. Anybody for that? I am, by God. Well, boys and girls, here's another story you might be interested in. Portland, Oregon, though the developers of the soon-to-be-released Driving While Black smartphone application wants motorists to download their product. There is a time when they can definitely don't want users searching for it. "Do not reach for your phone when you're talking to police," stressed Melvin Odin R., one of the two Portland lawyers creating the app. "Avoiding moves that could make police think you're reaching for a gun is just one tip included in the app that educates Black drivers about how to safely deal with police stops, traffic stops." Despite its attention-grabbing name, Odin Orr said the app, due for release in late December, will provide common-sense advice to Black motorists, they say of all races, and outline what civil rights you have during a stop, with the phone hopefully in a hands-free device. The app allows the driver to send an alert to friends and family that they have been pulled over. There's also a recording function to document the interaction with the officer. Well, this sounds like a pretty good deal for lone wolves, too, I'll tell you, man. The app is coming to market as protesters around the country keep attention on instances of deadly encounters with police. Three Georgia teenagers created a 5-0, an app released this summer that lets people rate their interactions with law enforcement. And last month, American Civil Liberties Union affiliates in four states unveiled Mobile Justice, an app that allows users to take video of police encounters and upload the video to the ACLU. It's modeled on the Stop and Frisk Watch, an app released for New Yorkers in 2012. The ACLU earlier this year renewed its call for an end to consensual vehicle searches by police after a new report suggested that racial profiling in Illinois is still a significant problem. It's obviously in the forefront of everyone's mind. The police know that they're being recorded, and people in public know they can record, says Sarah Rossi, director of the advocacy and policy for the ACLU Missouri affiliate. Quote, I think the benefit of this app, Mobile Justice specifies specifically, is it goes straight to the ACLU and we can review it for any due process violations. Well, I don't know whether they, if you're a Ku Klux Klansman and send it into the ACLU, whether they'd be too quick to act on it. They'd probably put it in file 13 for a while, yeah. Well, that's interesting. I think by and large that's a good idea. See what the niggers have helped bring to us? You should be thankful, white boy. Well, black officers now are torn between duty and race. That's what I've told you in a breakdown in this country. Sooner or later, probably sooner than later, the cops will square off against each other, white against black and so forth. It might take a little while, but it'll happen. Georgie Jinho Faria feels the tension between being black and carrying a badge every day as sheriff's deputy in Alameda County, California. Quote, I feel like you have to prove yourself on every level, says Faria, 39, who patrols about 30 miles east of San Francisco. You have to prove yourself to the Negro community, you have to prove yourself to all your co-workers, and you have to prove yourself to society. Well, I think you ought to get another job. With the nation roiled by two grand juries' recent decisions not to indict white police officers in the deaths of unarmed black men, you know, your body can be a weapon. I mean, even if you didn't know judo or anything like that, your body can be a weapon. If you're a 300-pound nigger and you sit on top of a 150-pound cop, some black officers say that they enforce the law. As they enforce the law, they also wonder whether the system they're sworn to uphold is stacked against black men. Well, I hope you keep feeling like that. Because the more you feel like that, the more we'll separate the races, at least ideologically. In interviews conducted by the Associated Press, reporters across the nation, retired and active black officers expressed concern about how black men are treated by largely white police forces. You know, they're never treated good enough. You notice that with a black? He's always... You know, I think they were taught well by the Jews about that. Okay, well, let's see. That's enough of that silly stuff. But it does point out already the murmurs are in the ranks, and if things come down to the wire, you're going to see military and police start breaking up over race. Says, we know about the skyrocketing black-on-black murders in major cities, but there is a subtle and more insidious form of black-on-black crime that is devouring the souls of millions of black Americans. The common thread behind the organized chaos unleashed on innocent people is the incitement by liberal black leaders. Oh, they wouldn't do that, would they? Black-on-black crime is being perpetuated on the souls of black Americans from the president on down. The crime is committed every time the black leadership deliberately stokes the anger of black people. Anger consumes and kills the soul, if you can find it. Black leaders say black lives matter, yet they're teaching their black youth to hate, showing that black lives don't really matter. Misguided hate drives blacks to hurt and kill, and it destroys the hater too. When Barack Obama supports the lie that cops routinely mistreat communities of color, that encourages blacks to hate, thereby damaging their souls, man. I didn't know shoes had anything to do with it. When so-called black leaders conflate the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner to advance the tale that white cops intentionally kill innocent black males, that's a form of black-on-black crime. Well, this is from, I guess, this is a conservative-type magazine of some type. Let's see about this poor Vietnamese fella who just came to Australia to better himself. A small shared Bankstown apartment, an old sedan, a job as a waiter, and dole payments. Such was the meager world of a Vietnamese refugee, Pete Tan Hong. Except for as much as $1 billion that he gambled at Australia's biggest casino, Crown Melbourne, in a little over a decade. Hong, 36, was shot in the face in September while waiting on a darkened street in suburban Sydney. His murder has left police perplexed, but has also shined a light on massive laundering on the behalf of a global crime syndicate with links across Asia and the Americas and the United States, and highlighted the scale of the narco money laundering problem in Australia. Gee, it was nice the way they let that guy in. Poor little Vietnamese refugee. Hong's story has rise from a Vietnamese-born orphan living on a refugee visa to one of Australia's biggest gamblers and money launderers. Also raises concerns about how he was able to rort the system for so long and for so much money, particularly at Australia's biggest casino. Court documents from recent cases revealed Hong ran as much as $1 billion in black cash through the Crown Gambling Casino between 2000 and 2012. Busy boy. He also was allowed to gamble under four different names and received a slew of perks, including overseas holidays, cash gifts of as much as $100,000, and gambling commissions in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and a whole raft of white women. Hoes. The Australian Crime Commission estimates that at least $15 billion a year is laundered in and through Australia each year. Other estimates suggest it's higher. Much of that money is the result of drug trafficking. Most federal crime agencies in Australia acknowledge that they face an increasingly monumental struggle against global crime groups seeking to launder their multi-billion dollar narco profits. Well, oh, these are just nice little Vietnamese refugees and trying to better their life and get a job and have a family and be good Australians while he's passing $1 billion worth of black money to the casino. And you want more of them, huh? Well, you're going to get them. You're going to keep getting them. Well, guess what? The federal government, which still has pot as a crime, a federal crime for any of us slaves out here, but the U.S. won't stop Native American Asians from growing and selling pot on their lands, opening the door for what could be a lucrative and controversial new industry on some Native American reservations, the Justice Department. How about that? Now they're going to be given the right. Now they already got a whole lot of gambling casinos. Now they're going to allow them to corner the large areas for growing pot. Isn't that wonderful? Aren't the Mongols a wonderful group of people? And even worse, though, is the FBI, famous but incompetent assholes that should be dumped. Let's dump the FBI. We don't need the FBI. Each state should have its own, use its own policing. Now, the shoe on the other foot is this. Bowdoin, which is a college campus, is to discipline 14 lacrosse players for dressing as Native American Mongols. 14 Bowdoin College men's lacrosse players faced disciplinary action by the school for dressing up as Mongol Indians at an off-campus party. An off-campus party. I'm telling you, man, it's getting something else. Yeah, I think Obama's going to try to raise more hell than you could imagine before he goes out of office. Here, the Bowdoin College is disciplining several students because they dressed in the headdresses and war paint for Cracksgiving, their annual Pilgrims and Native American party. Cracksgiving. Wow. Well, I hope they come down on everybody. You know, just get the boot down there. Come on, get that goddamn boot down. Step on those, especially those white people. Get that right down on that neck. Yeah, worse is better. Especially a lot of these college students have rich daddies. Rich white corporate daddies. Oh, isn't this sweet? Mongol Americans are writing the most powerful country music today. Oh boy, there goes the neighborhood. No actual docket names are given for this case, but if valid, it confirms the subversive intent of the Smithsonian Institute from day one, as many of us have always known, to suppress the early white aboriginal presence in the Americas and reinforce the probability that white people were the first Americans. Not only that, but also that white people were the earliest civilizing influence in the Americas. The U.S. Supreme Court ruling has forced the Smithsonian Institute to release classified papers dating from the early 1900s that proves the organization was involved in major historical cover-up of evidence showing giant human remains in the tens of thousands have been uncovered all across America and were ordered to be destroyed by high-level administrators to protect the mainstream chronology of human evolution at the time. The U.S. Supreme Court ruling has forced the court to release classified papers dating from the early 1900s that proves the organization was involved in a major historical cover-up of giant human remains in the tens of thousands that have been uncovered all across America in order to be destroyed by high-level administrators. Interesting, huh? There you go, baby. They just keep doing it. And then you wonder why we say we've got every reason in the world to start killing. Like the nigger said, kill a whitey, you know. Well, we've got every reason in the world to do some of that stuff. So, but just hang on. It'll get better. Better is what? Worse is better. Well, here is another ray of good news. We Jews, he says, that's Dennis Prager, who I've debated before. He's a real kike. We Jews produce many wonderful people. We also produce a uniquely large number of people who devote their lives to hurting their own people. Wait a minute. The Jewish communists in the Soviet Union, who helped the state oppress Jews and suppress Judaism, are a well-known example, but in our time, these Jews are legion. Wow. I guess we don't need the Hollywood Nazis anymore, huh? On Thanksgiving Day, I encountered this at the University of Oxford. where I debated along with Rabbi Shumli Boteach, two virulently anti-Israel spokesmen. One of them was Avi Shalom, an expatriate from Israel who has devoted his life to using his professorship at Oxford to promote anti-Israel activism. Wow. This is something else, man. The proposition debated at Oxford was Hamas is a greater obstacle to peace than Israel. Rabbi Boteach and I argued in support of the proposition, and Schleim and his debating partner argued against the proposition. That this proposition was even debated at Oxford is a moral intellectual scandal. Can't have that free speech. You know what that leads to? Gas chambers. As I ask in my opening remarks, in the 1930s, did Oxford Union debate the proposition, quote, Great Britain is a greater obstacle to peace than Nazi Germany? Here are some examples of what Schleim said to hundreds of Oxford students. Let me see here. The motion before this House is preposterous because it blames the victim, Hamas, and exonerates the oppressor, Israel. Israel is no longer a democracy. There is another word to describe the situation, apartheid. And on it went. But anyhow, the main thing was the headline that Jews more and more are joining the Jews that are bashing Jews. Now, how are the Nazis going to handle that? How are the Hollywood Nazis? If you got Jews going after Jews, you wouldn't want to go against them. You got to leave them alone, man. They're doing a number. Oh, man, what a world. That's about it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow, Freya's Day. This is Thor's Day. I didn't even give the date, did I? December 11th, 2014. And like I say, tomorrow. Well, I see now finally the symbol of the moon on my clock here has got a sliver of light there, which means it's going back into a small moon. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow, and I'm going to play some music for the She-Wolves tomorrow, and I hope they like it. 14-5, and shut your pie hole, boy, and think white, act white, be white, and being a white supremacist is a badge of honor.
The difference between a history embroidered with propaganda, such as we find, for example, in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, and a fantasy placed into a historical setting. Such an example would be Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. The Jesus Tale is very much in the latter category, a fictional drama in which a stereotypic hero has been intruded into a more or less realistic historical landscape. As we would expect from a fictional creation, there exists not a single contemporary reference to such a character, not a single genuine artifact, nothing to substantiate that he ever walked the earth. The traditional authorized version of Christian origins is a Big Bang theory. It suggests that one fine day, the only begotten son of God materialized in a virgin's womb. He grew to manhood, assembled his disciples, imparted his wisdom, died, and rose again. From this a religion was born. How far should the rational thinker buy into this story? The idea of Jesus convinces many that someone must lie beneath the encrusted legends. Many, of course, reduce the Christian superstar to a dimly perceived good man, who perhaps said some wise words, fell foul of Roman and Jewish authorities, and managed to get himself crucified. The Big Bang theory now boils down to little more than Christianity exists, it must have begun somewhere, it began with a single character, here's my version of who he really was. And favourites include an itinerant philosopher, or a religious reformer, a pacifist like Gandhi, or a militant like Che Guevara. In fact, Jesus has been reformed 100 times. One thing of which historians and New Testament scholars are well aware is the trajectory by which the Jesus Tao developed from an original text. Matthew, Luke, and even the fourth gospel build on a brief original Tao without miracles and post-death appearances, written at an uncertain date by an anonymous author. Church tradition alone identifies this as Mark. Matthew took the story off in one direction, and he packed the text with prophecy. Luke, in contrast, trawled through the works of Josephus for cool tidbits of historical accuracy. Whatever else, eyewitness testimonies they are not. And the story was all but unknown until the second half of the second century. Aware of these difficulties, New Testament scholars suggest a number of traditions preceded the Gospel tales. And what do these earlier traditions tell us of Jesus? The Essenes anticipated Christianity in a number of respects, as did the Therapeutes of Egypt, held by the church historian Eusebius as early Christian monks, yet they were established well before the Christian era. What then are we to make of the thinly drawn life of Jesus? It certainly appears to owe an extraordinary amount to Jewish scripture, whether drawn from Adam, Moses, Enoch, Melchizedek, Elijah, Elisha, etc. And it's a vast anticipation of the words and deeds of Jesus. Christian apologetics uses the words fulfillment, but a simple word copying explains the same. What are we to make of the multitude of parallels to Jesus' law to be found in ancient world mythology? Even the embarrassed church fathers spoke of diabolical mimicry. It seems that Satan himself clearly understood the true message of the Jewish prophets and was thus able to preempt Christianity centuries before the arrival of Jesus by copycat gods. In fact, we have absolutely no trace or mention of Jesus' exploits anywhere until the Gospels were written decades after the purported events. Desperate to penetrate this fog, some scholars strive to identify an early layer of teaching, said to derive from an historical Jesus. But does a sayings tradition really point to a single author of wise words? The Bible itself provides an answer. We have a sayings collection in the book of Proverbs, which is attributed to Solomon, but it was standard practice in the ancient world to lend authority and prestige to new material by falsely accrediting a prestigious figure from the past. But even more fatal to the claim of a sayings tradition is the patent failure of anyone to record any of the supposed astounding new teachings at the time. If a great multitude throughout Syria, Galilee and the Judea heard and believed, how odd that no one recorded those sparkling gems of wisdom. The truth is that Christianity grew from neither a god nor a man, but out of what had gone before. A human Jesus was no more necessary than was a human Horus, Dionysus, Mithras, etc. Can we explain the emergence of Christianity without its superstar? Of course we can. For two centuries the Christian movement languished, and thanks to civil war it got its big chance. It was the ultimate product of ancient religious syncretism. But it isn't history, it isn't truth, it's more astounding rubbish from the New Testament.